Welcome to this Ubula audio presentation of The Whispering Box Mystery by John Blaine. Volume 9, Chapter 21, Tricked. Rick's eyes wouldn't stay unglued. From the moment he had opened them at the hotel, they had tried to close again. He couldn't remember ever having been so sleepy. Scotty, Hartson Brandt, Zircon, and Kepner seemed to be in about the same condition. Weiss and Bertona had refused point-blank to get up. The only one with any pep was Gizmo McLean, who had been waiting in front of the hotel when the weary group of spindrifters came from a hurried breakfast. Gizmo was parked around the corner next to one of the yawning cars. Only the possibility that they might need him and his cab had kept him from joining them in the lobby. Steve Ames had met the group as they came up from the building's cellar, and assigned them to shadowy corners of the lobby. "Remember, you're here as spectators," he warned them. "My boys will do all that's necessary." There were four of the Yannick men in the lobby itself. Half a dozen others were outside at various vantage points. One was on the roof of a building across the street with a rifle. At both corners of the block were cars ready for instant action, and their ace in the hole, Screaming Susie, waited silently behind the cloth drapery. The counter was busy now. The clerks sold copies of the publications to people who drifted through the lobby or paused on their way out of the building. The traffic wasn't very heavy. Rick had no trouble seeing every person who passed through. Steve had chosen his trap wisely. The rear and side doors of this particular building were always locked from the outside. Of course, Goss might have a Confederate in the building to open a door for him, but Steve had placed a guard at every entrance. If the Whispering Box gang entered the building at all, it would have to be by the front door. Rick licked dry lips and fought to keep from falling asleep. Scotty was standing a few feet away, lost in thoughts of his own. Hartson Brandt was on the other side of the lobby with Zircon and Kepner. All of them were concealed from anyone who came through the entrance. By the time the person was far enough inside to recognize them, the trap would be sprung. Steve Ames was not to be seen. Rick yawned cavernously. He tried to stifle it, but it was too vast a yawn for that. Scotty chuckled. "Thought you were going to swallow the whole building." "Even rough marble in my stomach wouldn't keep me awake for very long," Rick said. "Hope we don't have to wait forever." Scotty pointed to the wall clock. It lacked only a minute to 11:30. "Any time now. Keep awake." More people were coming into the building now. That was wrong. Steve had said that traffic into the building would fall off at this time. Rick watched the incoming people carefully and saw that they were confused. Most of them headed for the building directory on the wall near the elevators. Some questioned the uniformed guard at the door. Rick began to fear that Goss, Nails, and company might slip by in that crowd, but he saw that the Yannick men were alert. The crowd thickened. More people were coming into the lobby. They were all men, most of them young. They stood uncertainly, as though waiting for something. Now and then one of them questioned the guard or the clerk at the publications counter. There was something very strange going on. Rick snapped out of his lethargy as Steve Ames came through the door of the lobby. Steve stopped short of the sight of the growing crowd. Rick ran to his side.
"Steve, what's up?"
"We'll find out," Steve said. He tapped the shoulder of the nearest man. "Say, what's with the crowd, mister?"
The man turned.
"Didn't you see the ad?"
"Ad? What ad?"
The stranger drew a newspaper from his pocket.
"In this morning's Post."
He pointed to an advertisement he had circled in pencil. Rick and Steve read it quickly. "Wanted, young men for service with the government outside the country, highest salaries, living quarters and expenses guaranteed, no experience necessary, but the applicant must be in good health. Apply promptly at 11:30. The name of this building was the only address. Steve Ames turned white. This ad is a phony. No one in the building placed an ad like that. He raised his voice to a yell, warning his men. Watch it. The crowd is a cover. Get them out of the building. Hurry. For an instant, there was shocked silence. Rick grasped what Steve meant. Goss must have placed the ad, knowing it would attract a crowd of young men that would cover his own entrance. The Yannig men couldn't use their guns in a crowd like this. Then the silence was shattered by Zircon's distinctive bellow.
It's Nails! Steve, watch out!
Rick saw one of the crowd near Zircon lift a black box, and then came the terrible, deafening blast of Susie's scream. Chapter 22. The Getaway. Susie's hair-raising howl subsided and gave way to the pounding of shoe leather on the tile floor. The crowd in the lobby didn't know what had happened, but no one was curious enough to wait and see. That scream had been too much. The men broke for the door. Rick and Steve started for Nails, but the press of people blocked their way. Steve was shouting orders that were lost in the confusion. The men at the doors got in each other's way, effectively jamming the entrance. From somewhere in the crush of men came a loud shout, and Susie wailed again. Rick quailed before the blast. It hurt his eardrums and almost deafened him, but he kept trying to push through. From the corner of his eye, he saw Scotty also trying to get through the crowd. He couldn't tell whether or not the Whispering Box gang was trapped in the building. He could only hope they were with everyone else. Goss had pulled a masterstroke this time. Suspecting that the building would be heavily guarded, the Whispering Box leader had placed a false ad, knowing it would give him the best protection of all, a crowd. Under the cover of the crowd, he and his men could have walked into the building, into the office suite where the supposed secret was kept, and out again, secure in the protection of the Whispering Box and in the knowledge that the officers of the law couldn't shoot into a mob of innocent people. But Goss hadn't thought Susie would be ready so soon. More men were getting out through the doors. Rick shoved and pushed and made headway, Steve beside him. They reached the doors and with a concerted effort broke through the crowd of men, looking for some sign of the Whispering Box gang. They were in time to see more of Goss's careful planning. A car swept to the curb and slowed. Three men leapt from the crowd and got in. The car spurted forward.
They won't make it, Steve said swiftly. My men are at the corner.
But another car entered the scene. A maroon convertible had been parked at the curb, close to the corner. Now it raced into action, ahead of the car that held the gang. Rick stood petrified, watching. He didn't even hear the rifle from the opposite rooftop as it barked away at the fleeing car, driving steel-jacketed bullets through the turret top. A heavy sedan swung out of the cross street to block the way. Steve's men were waiting. But the maroon convertible, racing ahead of the getaway car, never slowed. It plowed at full speed into the Yannig sedan, striking shrewdly just behind the front bumper. The two cars locked together, spun under the impact, and left enough space for the getaway sedan to pass. Rick saw the figure of the driver leap from the shattered convertible and swing to the running board of the getaway car as it passed. And then the Whispering Box gang was speeding out of sight. Steve went down the building steps in long leaps, Rick close behind him. Another Yannig car was coming down the street from its post at the corner behind the action. But Gizmo McLean's cab was there before it. Steve piled in, Rick at his heels.
Get going, Steve commanded.
The acceleration snapped Rick against the cushion. He regained his balance and turned for a look through the rear window. The Yannig car had slowed. Men were getting in, Scotty among them. Then Rick turned his eyes to the front and kept them there, meanwhile holding on for dear life. Far ahead, the gang car careened around a corner. Gizmo swung past a delivery truck, almost going up onto the sidewalk to miss it. He fought the taxi to an even keel and jabbed the pedal to the floor. The corner came and they took it without slowing. tires wailing in protest. Gizmo straightened out and kept going. Rick said shakily, "We banked like a plane on that corner." They went through a red light as though it didn't exist. A police whistle screeched and was lost behind them. The car ahead wasn't gaining, but neither were they. The chase went across Pennsylvania Avenue, past the upraised arms of a traffic officer. There was just a glimpse of his open mouth, then he too was gone. From somewhere in the rear came the sound of a siren. Rick tore his eyes from the scene ahead and looked back. The yawning car was gaining slightly and coming past it. Bent over his handlebars was a motorcycle officer. Gizmo leaned on the horn and kept his hand there. Cars moved out of their way, some a shade too slowly, so that Gizmo had to swing the taxi like a mammoth ballet dancer. Rick lost track of the close calls. Once there was even the rasp of metal as their fender kissed a slow-moving truck.
"Where's he headed?" Rick asked breathlessly.
"Memorial Bridge, I think," Steve replied tensely. "That's a fast car. If he gets across the bridge, he may lose us."
"He won't,"
Gizmo said briefly from the front seat. Ahead, the gang car passed an intersection, barely missing a black car. Rick choked on his heart because it leapt into his throat. The black car was a hearse. A funeral procession was crossing in front of them. The cars came close together. Gizmo's horn tooted rhythmically, but he didn't slow down. The taxi roared up at the line of cars. They were almost bumper to bumper. Gizmo blasted the horn at them. Rick could almost read the thoughts of the drivers. They had the right of way, a privilege accorded to such processions. They would not stop for a mere taxi, even a berserk one. They were too close now. They would smash broadside right into the line. A horrified driver saw the juggernaut bearing down on him and jammed his brake to the floor. A space opened and the taxi shot through. Rick slumped back in the seat. And for all the while, Steve Ames kept yelling, "Faster! Faster!" Constitution Avenue passed in a blur of cars and wheeling landscape as Gizmo weaved through the traffic, horn blaring. Ahead, the gang car sped toward Memorial Bridge. Gizmo leaned over the wheel and coaxed the taxi to greater efforts. Then they were on the bridge, going so fast that the rough cobbled surface didn't even jar them. Rick vowed later that the taxi only touched the ground at every 100th brick. At the other side of the bridge, the gang car swung right. For a moment, there was doubt. Would they head toward Falls Church or go in the opposite direction toward Alexandria? The doubt was resolved as the taxi took the turn on two wheels. The gang car had taken the ramp to the south. They were in the open now, on a broad concrete highway. True to Steve's prediction, the gang car began to pull away. From behind, the siren crept up on them. Rick risked another look. The yawning car was closer, and the motorcycle cop had almost caught up. The highway unrolled before them, and far ahead, Rick saw the broad shape of the Pentagon building. He caught a glimpse of motion from the corner of his eye and turned as the motorcycle officer, bent low over his handlebars, rolled past with siren pulsing. The motorcycle couldn't be pushed to excessive speed on city streets, but here on the broad highway, it could catch almost any car. Rick looked at the speedometer in the cab, almost 80 miles an hour, yet the motorcycle officer was pulling away from them. The road curved in a long, slow sweep. They went past other cars that had gone to the side of the road at the sound of the siren. The yawning car was almost at their rear bumper, and the motorcycle was a good distance ahead. The caravan swept toward a fork in the road, and for an instant the gang car slowed in indecision. That was instant enough. Brief though the moment of slowing had been, it had given the motorcycle officer time to gain more than 100 yards. Rick held his breath as the officer drew his gun from his holster. He sighted across the handlebars, fired, sighted, fired, and fired again. It was a fourth shot that brought results. The rear tire in the gang car exploded. The sedan swerved, slid sideways, tires screaming and smoking on the concrete. But the driver, by sheer strength, pulled the car out of its deadly spin and held it steady. The taxi's tires were smoking, too. Rick heard the spine-chilling howl of tortured rubber and felt the whole car shudder. He held on for dear life and noticed that Steve's hands gripped the back of the front seat so hard that his knuckles were white. The motorcycle officer, unable to slow as rapidly as the cars, shot on past the careening sedan to safety. As the taxi ground to a shuddering stop, Rick saw the doors on the gang car fly open. Three men leapt out and ran. Two of them were carrying black boxes. Nails was not among them. Rick had the door open by the time Gizmo brought the cab to a stop. He didn't need Steve's urging to get moving. He jumped from the cab and ran after the three men. The chase had come to an end, a short distance past the Pentagon building. The men were running toward the building at top speed. They leapt a low cement wall and vanished from sight as the ground dropped away to the Pentagon grounds from the built-up highway. The Yannick sedan was unloading, too. Rick saw Scotty get out, but he couldn't wait for his friend.
"Hurry," Steve Ames yelled. "If they get into the building, we'll lose them."
Rick stretched his legs and really ran. He went over the cement wall, Steve on his heels. They skidded down the rock embankment to the cement road at the bottom, and ahead, going into the vast car-filled parking area, they saw the three men. Steve waved his arms in command. The Yannick men scattered, going in opposite directions to surround the building. The motorcycle officer had finally stopped, turned around, and was rolling down a ramp into the parking space.
"We've got them," Steve exulted. "Dave will radio, and in 10 minutes we'll have a net thrown around this area that a cockroach couldn't crawl through."
Rick looked at the huge building.
"I'm not so sure," he said doubtfully. "That looks like an easy place to get lost in."
Chapter 23. The Box Again. From the highway past the Pentagon came the sound of sirens. The police were arriving, three cruisers and a half dozen motorcycles. Steve Ames paused at the sound. He turned to Rick.
"You and Gizmo keep out of this. You're not armed, and Goss and his men are. Keep out of the way and let the police take care of things."
Scotty arrived, running as Steve Ames left.
"What's up?" he demanded.
"We're supposed to keep out of it," Rick said. He realized that what Steve said made sense, but he didn't like it. To be on the job so long and then to stand by while others caught the criminals?
"Well, I like that," Scotty exclaimed. "Where'd a Goss go?"
The wave of Rick's arm took in row after row of parked cars in the great south parking area of the Pentagon. There were hundreds of cars, and Goss and his two men were in there somewhere. The sirens were screaming into life again. As Rick, Scotty, and Gizmo watched from outside the first line of cars, the police cruisers and motorcycles moved into positions evenly spaced around the parking area. Goss and his men were trapped.
"That thug Joe was with Goss," Rick said. "I recognized him. I think the other one was with the man who drove the van. But how about Nails and the fifth man?"
"In the maroon convertible," Scotty said. "Didn't you see Steve's man shooting from the roof back at the government building? Nails has a smashed shoulder, and the other guy has a bullet in his leg. Pete Davis is taking care of them."
Gizmo had been scanning the rows of cars. Now he grabbed Rick's arm.
"I saw one of them."
"Are you sure?"
Rick looked where Gizmo pointed, but he couldn't see anybody.
"I'm sure. It looked like that guy Joe."
Scotty's eyes narrowed.
"Well, you bet they separated. They're too smart to stay together."
That sounded reasonable to Rick. He had another thought. They still have whispering boxes, too. What's to prevent them from knocking down anybody who goes after them? If they can stay hidden until after dark, they'll have a chance to get away.
"They don't have to stay hidden until after dark," Scotty pointed out. "If they can stay out of sight until office hours are over, there'll be a mob of maybe 3,000 or 4,000 people milling around out here. It would take an army to check all of them."
Rick surveyed the parking area.
"I'll bet they plan to stay hidden, too. Listen, suppose we separated. We could sneak in and out among the cars and maybe get behind them."
"What good'll that do?" Gizmo demanded. "Suppose we do get behind them. Do we call him names or maybe throw pebbles at him? We don't even have clubs, much less guns. And you could bet those guys have guns as well as those whispering boxes."
"He's right," Scotty said sensibly. "We can't do anything." The Yannig men were gathering on the roadway. Rick pointed as Steve Ames motioned them into line, then spread out. They started for the parking area. All of them were armed.
"They're going to go right through this area," Scotty said, voice hushed. "There's going to be some shooting."
Gizmo gestured toward the windows at the other side of the building. Every available space was occupied with employees watching the drama unfolding below. They couldn't know what was going on, but they were aware that it was something extraordinary.
"They have box seats," Gizmo observed. "And there's no reason why we shouldn't have it, too,"
a new voice bellowed. The boys turned to greet Zircon, Hartz and Brandt, and Dr. Kempner, who were coming toward them from the road. The three scientists had been left behind in the wild chase, but had caught up in a police cruiser. They had already been briefed on the situation.
"I suggest we go into the building,"
Kempner said. He waved a whispering box.
"We can see what's going on from a window. Steve Ames is right. Since we're unarmed, it would be extremely foolish to interfere."
"Where'd you get the box?" Rick asked.
"From the gang car. It was empty otherwise. Goss would have taken it with him. It's evidently the one that caused Susie to go off."
Kempner showed them the two punctured cartridges he had removed from the box. They fell in with his suggestion that they watch from the building and hiked toward the nearest entrance. As they went, Rick told his father about the wild ride. Hartz and Brandt smiled grimly. "We didn't linger on the way either." At the door, a building guard stopped them. One of Steve's men had already alerted the building guards. Hartz and Brandt identified the group, and they were allowed to pass.
"Go up to Captain O'Malley's office," the guard suggested. "You could look out over the whole area from there."
He pointed toward the inner door that led to a staircase.
"One flight up, go past the exhibit, and turn right."
The scientist thanked him and led the way. Rick kept pace with his father, but he had to stretch his legs to do it. Hartz and Brandt had a long stride that seemed to cover yards when he was in a hurry. They went up the stairs and found an exhibit of Army Air Force's personnel equipment. It included pressure suits for fighter pilots, jet pilot helmets, oxygen masks, inflatable life jackets for overwater flying, fur-lined high-altitude boots, electrically heated mittens, and similar equipment. Rick's eyes took in the array automatically. He didn't slow down long enough for a good look. Captain O'Malley's name was on the door. Hartz and Brandt knocked, and a loud voice invited them to enter. They went in and found the office unoccupied except for a young red-headed officer. The officer introduced himself as O'Malley and heard a brief resume of the day's happenings and then motioned them to the windows.
"Make yourselves comfortable," he invited.
"This is the first time I've seen a real skirmish from a box seat. And watch that green station wagon in the 8th row, counting out from here. I think one of your fugitives is in there."
Rick, Scotty, and Gizmo squeezed together at one window. They looked out on the entire south parking area, with its row after row of cars. They could see the Yannig men and the police moving slowly down the rows of cars, pausing to examine each one. Around the area at regular intervals were the police cruisers and the motorcycles. Reinforcements were arriving from moment to moment, taking their place in the line. It was dramatic and exciting, the more so because both sides in the strange chess game were playing for keeps. Rick knew that Goss and his men would fight to the end. They had nothing to lose, because capture would mean trial and conviction on a charge of treason. Besides, if they could hold out for a while, their chances of escape were increased. It would take a long while for the advancing line of government men and officers to cross the parking area. They had to move slowly, not knowing where their quarry had gone to ground. Now and then, Rick lost sight of one of the men in the maze of cars. He wasn't good at estimating distances, but the parking area looked about a quarter of a mile long and half as wide. He later found that to be a good guess, and the huge area was packed with cars. A shouting from nearby windows made him jump. The watching crowd had yelled as one of the gang crossed an open space between two cars. The brief appearance of the figure made Rick watch more closely. The gang had to stay near the middle of the parking lot. He was rewarded by the sight of Goss himself scurrying from car to car. The parking lot was crisscrossed with driveways. The gang men had to cross the driveways occasionally as the pressure of the advancing line kept them on the move. After a while, Rick thought he could make out a planned strategy. Goss was moving steadily toward the building, dashing across the open spaces, losing himself among the cars, then making another dash for it. Rick tried to locate Steve and saw him at the end of the line of cars nearest the building. He calculated swiftly. If the pace kept up, Goss and Steve would meet eventually, about 100 yards down from where he stood at the window. If only there were enough men to put rifles at the windows. But that wouldn't be a sure way. Goss and his men moved fast when they were in the open, and the range was pretty great. He wondered why building guards hadn't been posted, and decided that there weren't more than enough of them to guard the entrances. Goss appeared again, for a brief moment as he crossed an open space. There was no doubt about it, he was making for the building. Rick couldn't be sure, but he thought the gang leader was carrying a whispering box. If he had one, he could reach the line of cars nearest the building, make a quick dash, and fire the box at the entrance. That way he could get past the entrance guard and into the building. Once in the building, finding him would take a huge number of men. Rick wasn't even sure they would get him. It would be possible to get away somehow. Prisoners had gotten out of jails that were especially made to hold them. The Pentagon wasn't a jail or even close to one, and Goss was clever enough to find a way. If Steve and Goss met in the line of cars, his friend might get hurt. Goss was in the fourth line now, about opposite an army car with a cracked window. Chance would decide. If Goss saw Steve a fraction of a second before Steve saw him, Rick said urgently, "Somebody ought to go down there and tell Steve where Goss is now." Gizmo showed no sign of leaving his place at the window.
"Tell him yourself," he suggested.
Scotty eyed Rick sympathetically.
"Tell you what, let's toss for it."
Three young men drew away from the window for a moment and each dug out a coin. "Odd man goes first," Rick said. The three coins dropped on the carpet and the boys leaned over them. Rick's was a head, so was Gizmo's. Scotty's was a tail. "Just my luck," Scotty groaned, but he abided by the whim of fate and ran for the door. Rick and Gizmo, both grinning their relief, resumed the vigil at the window. They saw Scotty emerge and head for Steve. For a moment the two were talking. Then Steve ran for the place Scotty had described, Scotty at his heels. Rick groaned in a sudden fright for his friends.
"Why doesn't he take it easy? If he shows himself, he's going to get shot, and so will Scotty."
"If we only had a rifle," Gizmo said. "If we only had anything, even one of them boxes."
"We've got one, but it's empty. No cartridges."
He broke off as Goss sneaked around the side of the car and vanished behind a panel truck. Goss couldn't see Steve and Scotty, nor could they see him. Scotty had picked up a large stone and was hefting it. Rick's heart did a loop. Was Scotty out of his mind? He couldn't fight an armed man with rocks. Steve found the army car with the cracked window, and moving slowly, he went around it and disappeared. Rick licked his lips. Steve was going into the maze of cars after Goss, and they were only a few cars away from each other. He got a quick glimpse of Goss again. The gang leader had moved over one row. For another instant, he was inside as he came around a car, and it wasn't a box in his hand. It was a gun. Steve moved into the maze, and Rick saw him move swiftly around a car. Steve had a gun, too. Scotty, moving with more caution, followed after him. Gizmo gasped.
"They're going in the wrong direction."
Rick saw it at the same instant. Goss's change of direction had fixed things so that the gang leader would be behind Steve and Scotty if they continued their present line. Let him get one quick look at them, and he would use the gun he held. Rick started away from the window and almost fell over the whispering box Kepner had placed on the floor. He stared at the thing. If he had... Wait, he did have... Wow! He let out an exclamation that made the others look up in astonishment. They were just in time to see him dash out the door with the empty whispering box. Rick's legs carried him almost as fast as wings, right down the hall to the exhibit. He had his fingers crossed. If only the jacket were complete. He skidded to a stop in front of the orange-colored life jacket.
It was the kind that could be inflated by pulling cords on the bottom. The cords pulled levers that forced pins in the carbon dioxide cylinders, cartridges, just like the ones used in soda water bottles, like the ones used in the Whispering Box. The screw top containers were in place. He unscrewed the tops as fast as his fingers would move. There was one cartridge inside. He pulled it out and examined the neck, afraid of what he might find. The tip end was unpunctured. The cartridge was good. It still had carbon dioxide in it. He didn't wait to get the second one from the jacket. He ran for the stairs, opening the back of the Whispering Box as he went. The cartridge rammed home, and he snapped the back of the box shut. The spring catch caught. The box was ready for use. The guard had no chance to question him. He was out the door too fast, running to where Steve and Scotty had entered the line of cars. Goss might have moved over a line from the last position he had seen, but he had to chance it. He ran into the maze of cars and began working his way toward where he thought Goss might be. It wasn't far ahead. He couldn't see any signs of other men, and he knew that the three ahead of him were crouching low, working their way from car to car. He dropped flat and peered under the line. He saw legs 2 cars away, and another 2 cars away were a pair of legs. He lay flat for a moment until he was sure all the shoes were pointing away from him, and he saw the nearest legs bend a little and move slowly. Goss had seen Scotty and Steve. He was going toward them. Rick got to his feet, breath unsteady. He bent low and went to the front of the car. In a moment he could see Goss come out to the front of the second car, beyond the one that concealed him. He leaned far forward and peered around the chrome grille. Goss appeared, back to Rick. The boy took his nerve in both hands and prepared to jump into the open, the box ready for use. And then he saw Goss's hand lift. Steve and Scotty, they were just coming out from behind a car. Backs were to Goss. Steve sprang forward, the Whispering Box lifting. His thumb found the button, and he let out a cry of warning for Steve and Scotty. 3 startled faces turned toward him just as the box whispered. All 3 of them wavered, fought for balance, and then fell to the ground, writhing. Chapter 24. Letter from Home. The scientists, except for Bertona, were sitting in Hartson Brandt's hotel room when Rick and Scotty entered. Hartson Brandt greeted them with a smile. "Everything finally under control?" "Perfect," Rick said. "Nails, Joe, and that other guy are in the hospital under guard. Goss and the other one are in the District Columbia jail, along with our old friend Fanning. We just came from there. Steve is downstairs. He'll be up in a minute." "Well, that's not all," Scotty said. "Guess what happened to the stuff they stole?"
"Let me guess," Zircon boomed. "Eaten up by mice?"
Scotty grinned.
"Try again."
"Used by the gang for sandwich wrappers,"
Wise suggested dryly. Hartson Brandt chuckled.
"Don't let them pull your leg, Scotty. It happens that Pete Davis phoned a moment after you and Steve left the jail."
"Oh," Scotty looked deflated.
"Anyway, they didn't have a chance to sell him."
"I guess that's what made Goss try for that one last big secret," Rick surmised. "The others went up in flame when the old mansion burned. He had to make one more try or fail entirely." Goss hadn't been obliging enough to admit that, but Yannick investigators, sifting every last ash of the old mansion, had found the remnants of the secret papers in a strong box that hadn't been fireproofed. Kepner smiled.
"What's this about giving you a medal, Rick?"
"Oh, nothing serious," Rick grinned. "Steve said something about awarding me what he called the Order of the Wriggling Worm. He also said something about making Scotty a Knight of the Bath with soap." The scientist laughed.
"I'll wager it isn't the first time a war has been won by someone lying on his stomach," Weiss said.
Rick had retained enough presence of mind to yell, "Get flat on the ground," and the quick-thinking Yannick agents had known at once what he meant. One agent some distance away had fired an instant after dropping to the ground, shooting Joe in the leg from under a half-dozen cars. After that, the 3rd gang member had howled he was ready to surrender.
"Davis said that a conviction is a matter of course,"
Kepner told them. Steve's men have reconstructed the secret documents from the ashes found in the house, if they need them for evidence. Fanning has already confessed a great deal. Only the judge, jury, and prosecutors and witnesses will know the truth. So far as the public knows, it'll be just another trial for armed robbery.
Rick almost jumped out of his skin as a shrill whisper sounded behind him. He whirled to see Scotty's innocent look on his face.
"Did I scare you? I was just trying to whistle," Scotty said.
Rick grinned. "You're just mad because I laid you low along with Goss. I suppose I'll have to be on guard, or I'll find itching powder in my bed some night."
"Forget it," Scotty said, smiling. "It was worth it."
Hartson Brandt tossed an envelope at his son.
"A letter for you, Rick. It's from Barbie. I had one from Mother, too. She wants to know when we're coming home."
"Tonight," Weiss said. "We'll take a sleeper."
Zircon chuckled.
"And we won't get off, even to answer a bleat from Gabriel's horn. That's a promise."
Rick tore the letter open and scanned it briefly, reading the highlights out loud.
"Barbie has a fine tan. She says things are dull at home and wants to know when we're coming back. Jerry Webster dropped in for a game of tennis. Professor Gordon has been doing the shopping, flying in my cub. Dismal caught the woodchuck." "Hey, did you hear that? Dismal caught the woodchuck," he read on. "He brought him home, the chuck, I mean. It was quite a job because the thing was almost as big as Diz. He must have shaken that chuck senseless because there wasn't any fight left in him, but he, the woodchuck, was still alive and not much harmed. Professor Gordon thought we ought to kill him, but he looked so unhappy and defeated, the woodchuck, I mean, that I made Professor Gordon put him in a burlap bag. Then we took him to the mainland in the boat and let him go. Dismal was with us, and he didn't even try to chase the woodchuck. I guess he felt gallant toward a defeated enemy, and I know I felt proud of Dismal. Like a brave and shining knight, he had vanquished the invader, and now he was generous toward the fallen foe, refusing his right of a coup de grace." Scotty commented. "She's been reading Tennyson again. I recognize passages from the Knights of the Round Table." "Not nice in the bath with soap?" Rick grinned. "Anyway, I'm glad they let the woodchuck go. He put up a good fight."
"Anything else?" Hartson Brandt asked.
"Yeah, let's see. She says there's a lot of mail for us. One letter from Chada in Hawaii. There's another one from Hawaii that's not from Chada. She doesn't know who it's from because she can't read the writing. And she says she can't see anything when she holds it up to the light bulb." He had a picture of Barbie burning with curiosity, holding the letter in front of the light.
"I guess we'd better get home before she dies of sheer wondering," Scotty said.
Hartson Brandt rubbed his chin thoughtfully.
"It may be from Dr. Warren. I remember he said something about a new expedition he was planning. He also said something about wanting Rick and Scotty to go along."
"What?"
Rick and Scotty shouted together. The door opened and Steve Ames came in.
"Who's yelling?"
he asked.
"We are," Rick said. "Dad, what's that all about?"
"Something about a trip down to the island south of Tahiti. I don't remember all of it. We'll talk about it later, Rick. Steve, do we have any more news?"
"Nothing you don't know," Steve said. He looked tired. "The case is almost closed so far as Yannick is concerned. We have only to locate the gang accomplice in New York, and Fanning has already given us a good lead. He's willing to talk, hoping the judge won't be too hard on him. The case is mostly up to the Department of Justice now."
Steve's smile included them. "I won't try to thank you. Thanks would not express it."
"No thanks necessary," Hartson Brandt said for all of them. "It was a privilege to help. How is Bertona?"
"Pretty disgusted with that cousin of his," Steve answered. "He feels especially chagrined that we had not mentioned his name at the time the FBI man was making his routine check. He hadn't seen Goss since they were both boys, up to the time of that meeting at the Pittsburgh Air Terminal."
He looked at Rick and Scotty and gave them a comradely grin.
"How about my two junior commandos? They're going to get bored if you take them back home where there's no whispering boxes to disturb the peace."
"We're going on an expedition," Rick said hopefully.
Yes, to Spindrift Island, Hartzenbrandt added. After that, we'll see. Scotty spoke up. Steve, I've been wanting to ask you something. Goss and his gang got away with some pretty valuable stuff, didn't they? I mean, the secrets that were burned?
You never told us what the secrets were, Rick said.
Steve sobered. He went to the door and opened it, peered up and down the hall, and then closed the door again. Went to the window, looked out, as though expecting to find an eavesdropper hanging from the windowsill. Then he turned to the now quiet group.
You've done an invaluable service for your country, he said seriously.
He spoke directly to Rick and Scotty.
Now I'm going to ask you to do something even harder.
Rick tensed. Scotty's voice was hushed. You mean not to divulge a word of what you're going to tell us?
Harder than that, Steve said. Much harder.
He lowered his voice and spoke in a confidential whisper. Rick and Scotty moved closer so as not to miss a single word. The twinkle in Steve's eyes broke through, and the scientist burst into laughter as he said,
I'm going to ask you not to ask any questions.
The end. We hope that you have enjoyed this Uvula audio presentation of The Whispering Box by John Blaine. This is your narrator, Jim Campanella. The Rick Brandt theme should be recognizable as the Johnny Quest theme, which was composed by Hoyt Curtin. Please feel free to write us and tell us what you think at uvulaaudio@uvulaaudio.com. You can also become a Facebook fan of Uvula Audio. Just do a search for Uvula Audio on Facebook, or you can do it from the main Uvula Audio webpage. As usual, check out our Cafe Press website for t-shirts, etc. For other Uvula Audio titles, please go to our website at www.uvulaaudio.com. We are listed on iTunes, and you can subscribe and download our podcasts for free from there. If you like our podcast, please feel free to tip us whatever amount you may like using the secure PayPal links at uvulaaudio.com. From all of us at Uvula Audio, we thank you.